This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom and who have endured some pretty remarkable things in that pursuit. And each week we visit with members of our greatest generation. The goal is to honor them for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, oftentimes inspired by these stories. And we're going to hear one today from a guy who's pretty young, 96 years young, going to be 97 in May, originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, but for the last 35 years a resident of Las Vegas, Nevada. And that's where we are today with Alan Dunbar, Purple Heart recipient, ex-prisoner of war, and longtime VA employee. But let's talk before any of that happened. Growing up in Philadelphia, what was your life like as a young boy? Were you rooting on the Phillies or the A's, the Athletics, or what?
Oh, I was an athletic fan. I was a baseball fan because I played baseball in high school. I was a good field, no hit.
Mm-hmm. Join the club.
But I I was a catcher. We had on the baseball team a screwball pitcher.
Ooh.
And he was a left-hander, and I was the only guy that could catch him. And he broke my little finger on my right hand three times.
Ouch. And that didn't help with the hitting either, I'm sure.
No, I was a good field, no hit. But I enjoyed the game, and it was more of an enjoyment for me that they even let me on the ball team. But this pitcher, he not only was a screwball pitcher, he was a screwball.
Kept you on your toes, huh?
Yeah.
And what high school was that?
West Philadelphia High School.
West Philadelphia High School. Were you a big Connie Mack fan? Did you go see those games?
I went to the athletic games. I was a fan of Connie Mack. I liked the way he waved his card as he sat in the dugout. And when he waved his card, the infielders and the outfielders would go to the position where he waved the card. And I'd be sitting in the stands with either my father or one of my brothers. You'd see him wave that card, and then Max Bishop, who was his second baseman, he'd move over where the manager told him to stand, and the next thing you know, the opposing batter would hit the ball right to Max. Mm-hmm. If he'd been to the other place, he would have got a single or a double. Connie Mack was the manager of the Philadelphia Athletics when baseball was baseball.
What are you saying it is now?
Too much money being passed around.
Amen. I've got to ask you, since you're such a baseball guy, who is the most amazing player that you ever saw in person there?
Lefty Grove.
Yeah.
When he came out to pitch, the fans stood up and clapped and clapped and clapped. Then they sat down and they watched this man go through his magic of pitching left-handed to the opposing team, and they were striking out 1, 2, 3. In the games that I saw, they were hitting the balls to the infielders. The outfielders, one of them even sat down for the inning.
I thought that only happened in Little League, not the American League.
Yeah, but Lefty Grove went out to him, and he stood up for the rest of the game.
So you finished West Philadelphia High School. You went to Temple University and graduated in 1940. What'd you get your degree in?
Transportation and traffic law. I tried to get a job in New York because that's where the major transportation people conduct their business. And it was impossible because I had a low number in the draft and nobody would hire me. And I couldn't blame him. So I went back and I told my father that I struck out. Well, he says, I think you ought to go to work until you're drafted. And I said, I agree, Dad. Well, he says, I'm a personal friend of the director of training or down there in Philadelphia refinery. He says, I can get the job down there. They're going to call you a sample chaser. I said, what's a sample chaser? He told me, he says, you know those large tanks you see in the field? You have to walk up iron steps to the top. Well, you carry a thing that has six bottles, like Coca-Cola bottles. You have to drop them down with a weight till it fills up, cork it, you label it where you got it from, what it is, and you stick it back. And then when you get a full case of six, you go back to the lab and test it for viscosity and all that business. So that's what I did.
Until the Army was ready for you.
Until the Army sent me a notice, dear Mr. Dunbar, your number has come up in the draft.
How'd you feel about that?
Well,
because the war wasn't going yet.
No, I didn't like being a private. The sergeant says, oh, a draftee, we'll take care of this guy. They're from the south and I'm from the north.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day we were out in a field in South Carolina. Major came around and he said, Fort Benning, Georgia is an infantry training camp. He says, you go down there for 3 months, and if you pass, you'll become a second lieutenant. So I went to OCS.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1941, I got a commission, and lo and behold, the Army's thinking, they sent me back to the same unit I was a private in. And the sergeant says, look, who the hell's got a second lieutenant's commission? And he left here as a private. And I says, isn't that a lucky thing for me? I didn't take it out on him. I thought better of it. And I learned a lot about what the Army did and why we had to fight the enemy. Kill them. You can't be a mealy mouth being a second lieutenant. Aim your pistol at somebody and pull the trigger and he doesn't walk away. So we were trained to kill.
But you didn't know who the enemy was yet.
We didn't.
But you'd find out pretty soon.
Oh, we found out pretty soon when I got transferred to the 29th Division and I was sent there as a communications officer.
So is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
That's where I was.
What do you remember about that day? Because everybody seems to remember something about where he was and how he found out the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor.
Well, this is the thing that bothered me. During when I was a child, my father took us to Japan. They were not our enemies then.
No.
They were our friends. I learned some Japanese words. I was a youngster then. But my father said when we came back to Pennsylvania, something strange. He said to me, Alan, I took you to Japan and the rest of your brothers because someday, this is my father speaking, someday we may be fighting the Japanese because they're interested in a global affair.
Wow.
With the United States. Now, I learned this from men who are knowledgeable about the Japanese history. So you may be fighting them someday, so don't make friends with anybody in Japan.
Wow. And how old were you?
9.
So this is the late 20s.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your brothers a couple times. How many brothers did you have?
2. They both went to the University of Pennsylvania. Oldest brother went on to become a doctor. And he went with the 3rd Marine Division over in Japan.
Yeah.
So some of the people that he was fighting against, the Japanese, were friends of his because he went with my father at the time. So he wrote to my father, and he says, what shall I do, Dad? He says, you are the oldest son. Use your better judgment.
Hmm.
If for some reason you see a friend of yours when you were a youngster, use your better judgment. I'm not going to tell you what to do.
Hmm.
As his younger brother, I said, I wouldn't want that responsibility at all.
Yeah. Well,
Bill. A friend's a friend to me.
And what about your other brother? What did he do during the war?
He was a commander in the Navy. He commanded a ship, a sub chaser. And unfortunately, my brother got killed. His ship was sunk by the Italians. All was lost on the ship. Was attacked by an Italian task force that was going out to the sea, and they happened to be right there by a small town of Italy, and they got caught with their pants down.
In the Mediterranean, then?
Yeah, in the Mediterranean. There were four or five battleships, and there was that a small attack cruiser, and the thing went down, and everybody was lost.
When did you learn of that?
I learned of that when I was training. I said, gee, what is Mom going to do? Her oldest son, he's a doctor. He commands a hospital. The middle son, his ship went down, and he was engaged to be married. I want to tell you this story because it has to be told. Middle son was engaged to be married to a Catholic girl. He signed over his government life insurance, $10,000 policy on his life, and he was killed. And you know what? She turned it down. She gave it to my mother.
Wow.
When I found out about that, I said to Kathleen, I said, why did you do that, Kathleen? She says, because your mother got nothing from raising a son to be killed in his service. She says, I wanted her to have the $10,000. What is the $10,000 going to do for me when I know that Joe has been killed? Now, I promised your mother, if I got married, our first son, I would name Joseph.
That's pretty amazing. And did she name her son Joseph?
Yes, she did. She sent me a picture of the baby.
Wow.
Well, that's one of those things. But I'll tell you, being a POW was the worst disgrace for me.
Well, I want to hear that story, and I'm just thinking about as you talk about your brother giving his life in the service of our country, that you came a lot closer than I'm sure you would have wanted to doing the same thing. But let's get you to that point. So you end up in the 106th Infantry Division?
Yes, I did.
And what was your duty?
I was the communications officer of the 422nd Infantry Regiment.
So what did that mean? What did a communications officer have to do?
Well, the communications officer was responsible for the communications of the entire regiment. From all the companies, I was responsible for laying the wires from the command headquarters of Colonel Deschenaux was the regimental commander. I had to make sure that my men laid wires to the 1st, the 2nd, and the 3rd Battalion of the 422nd Infantry so they would have communications with the regimental commander. When he got orders from the division commander, he had to get his main radio operator, send a message to every battalion commander with the order of battle. So that was my responsibility. And here I'm up at division headquarters. I'm up the tree.
You're taking me right to December of 44 now, as you're
taking you to December of 44.
So this is the Battle of the Bulge has just started.
The Battle of the Bulge started, and the old man, it's an affectionate term, the old man is the regimental commander.
Right.
He's younger than I am. But he's the old man.
Well, you were a pretty old man, relatively speaking, at 26 at the time, compared to a lot of the guys around you, I'm sure.
They were all young.
Yep.
I had 18 and 19-year-old kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had one man, his name was Canoy. He had two left feet. He was my radio operator. He could take 28 words a minute.
Wow.
Damn good. And the colonel said to me, he says, but he can't shoot. He's an infantry soldier first, and he can't shoot. He can't hit anything.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sir, it's not the question that he can't shoot, but he takes 28 words a minute. I am not going to get rid of them, sir. The regimental commander looks at me and he says, Alan, you're going to have the dumbest radio operator in your platoon. I said, sir, he may not be a good soldier. He doesn't have to be a good soldier for me. If he can take 28 words a minute, he can get radio calls from everybody. The whole division, there's nobody takes 28 words a minute. So he says, he can't even run the obstacle course. I said, sir, will you do me a favor? He says, anything, Alan. I says, if I get Kanoi to get over that 8-foot wall, will you get off my back? So he says, I'll do it if he gets over the wall. And I won't even mention his name again. I said, is that a promise, Colonel? He says, Alan, between you and I, that is a promise. And I won't tell anybody else.
All right.
I got him over the wall.
How'd you pull that off?
I said, Kanoi, I want you to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. There'll be nobody out here except you and me. So we met out on the obstacle course. I said, you stand here. When I yell at you, go, you run as fast as you can. And I'm going to be at the bottom of that wall with my hands cupped, and I'm going to throw you over the wall. He says, you're out of your mind. That's what he tells me. I said, try it. And he's way down there, and I yell at him, ready? Yes, sir. Go. He's running fast. He's only about 4'8", right? He's a little guy. And I says, you see my hands cupped? Hit with your left foot. So he went, and hey, boy, he went right on my feet, and I threw him over the wall, and I passed him.
The colonel didn't read the fine print on that promise, I guess, huh?
No.
He didn't say he couldn't have any help.
We need to catch our first commercial break, but remember that name, Kanoi, because it's going to come up again at the end of the show. You don't want to miss that. When we come back, we'll learn how Mr. Dunbar was wounded and captured on the same day, December 19th, 1944, the Battle of the Bulge. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 96-year-old Alan Dunbar of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In the middle of December 1944, he found himself in the Schnee Eifel, a mountain range near Germany's western border with Belgium. A communications officer with the 106th Infantry Division, he would be wounded and captured at the outset of the Battle of the Bulge. Even though the Army Service Manual said a division should cover no more than 5 miles worth of front, the 106th was trying to take care of 26 miles of front, and two of the 106th's three regiments, the 422nd and 423rd, were surrounded and cut off. So, Mr. Dunbar, geographically speaking, that's where you were, near Schoenberg, and you were surrounded.
Geographically speaking, I was the top of the telegraph pole in the division headquarters.
All right.
And the tree next to me was my wire chief, and he yells over to me, Captain, You ever see so many Indians? I said, what Indians? He says, I mean the Germans. I said, you tell your men to get the hell out on the ground immediately. I didn't want them to all get killed.
How close were the Germans?
I would say about 150, 200 yards from our command post.
Wow.
And they had artillery pieces out there, which the Germans normally don't have artillery pieces in their lower units. I didn't have any artillery. We had small weapons. We had pistols. We had rifles, grenades to throw.
So you're trying to establish communication lines for an upcoming battle, and all of a sudden the enemy's right on top of you.
Yeah. I had 48 men, and I had another lieutenant, and I had a warrant officer. And I knew every one of them by their first name.
Wow.
I felt a personal responsibility for each man. I had a wound. It creased my stomach. And I looked down and I says, oh my, well, of course, I was a lot thinner than I had today. I only weighed about 120 pounds, 127 pounds to be exact. And I weigh 153 now.
So this was a shrapnel from an artillery shell that got you?
I thought it was came from a rifle.
Oh, yeah?
Because the firing of the artillery shells explode.
Right.
Rifle shells don't explode.
Right.
They hit you. Either they go in your stomach or shoulder or whatever.
So this one went parallel to your stomach, went through, but didn't go in?
Didn't go in. Just greased me. I felt it. When I talked to the regimental commander, I says, I think I've been hit. What do you mean you think you've been hit? He says to me. I says, well, I'm looking down at my shirt and it's red. So I says, it wasn't red when I put it on. He says, Alan, he says, you're making fun of this war. I said, no, I'm not, sir. I want the men to know that even if I got wounded, I still are giving the orders they're supposed to hear.
Right.
I got to take care of my men, sir. Goodbye.
You're wounded while you're still up this pole.
Yeah, I got down.
You get down, and what happened next?
I got a hold of my wire sergeant, and I said, I want you to listen very carefully. The enemy, the Germans, outnumber us at least 2 to 3 to 1. Tell his men, the 23 men that he had in the wire section, to destroy their weapons, get the cover that they can get. Don't have name, rank, serial number. That's all you have to give. Don't tell them where we were, where we came from. Name, rank, serial number, and get rid of everything. I told them to destroy all the things that would tell the enemy what you did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want anything written down in English.
You're wounded. You're given all these orders because it's clear to you you're going to be captured.
Yes.
There's no getting out of this because there's just that many Germans?
Yes. They had us outnumbered at least 3 to 1. The wire sergeant said, can I give you my rifle? I said, no. It's your weapon. Use it. And then destroy it, because I don't want any weapons falling in the enemy's hands.
Right. Had you ever personally considered the possibility that you might be a prisoner?
Never gave it a thought. When I got captured, I was as bare as I hoped that the men were. I didn't have a weapon on me. I tore everything out of my wallet, buried my wallet. I had nothing on it to let the Germans know that I was the commanding officer of this unit.
You bury your dog tags too?
Buried my dog tags. Everything that identified me as an American soldier, I either buried, threw it under maybe a truck or something, and I took my pistol apart.
What I think might be an important question to ask here, did you receive an order to surrender?
They had a white flag.
Uh-huh.
They came over. And they said, in English, who is in charge? I said, I am. He says, I want you to surrender all your weapons and your ammunition. I says, it's been taken care of. He spoke some German words. He says, was is los? I said, nix is los. He says, you speak German? I says, no, I'm copying you. And my sergeant says to me, you're a character.
I guess so.
Captain, he says, I never heard a conversation like this in my whole life.
Well, and I'm sure it wasn't all laughs, though.
No, it wasn't all laughing.
What did they do with you guys?
Well, they separated me from my men.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like that at all.
They put you with other officers, and they took enlisted men with other enlisted men?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the thing about it, that was the last I saw of my enlisted men. You know, I was in prison camp, an officer's camp.
Were you in pain from the shot to your midsection?
I wasn't thinking about it. I was thinking about the men.
For you, with that wound, if it went crossways across the front of your stomach, had you been turned a little bit differently, that would have gone
in.
It would have gone in.
I would have died.
It would have killed you.
Yeah. A battle like that can be a game of chance. I felt lucky.
I imagine so. I know that you feel pretty fortunate to have survived, and that there's a man in particular that you feel helped save your life. And I want to get to that, but I want everyone to understand, because most people listening have no idea what it's like to be a prisoner, especially not of the Germans, in the winter of 44 and 45 and on into the spring. Was there anything about your interrogation that stood out to you?
Well, not my particular interrogation. It was the manner in which this man, Lieutenant Colonel John Waters, became a person of renown to me because he saved my life. We met at Oflok 64 in Poland.
This is where you were a prisoner. So this is, they've taken you there in one of those cattle cars, the 40 and 8s, packing three or four times as many people as should be in there.
181 officers are there.
Wow.
They were standing up.
So you're taken to Poland, and you're in this prison camp.
Right.
How was the food?
The food, they received German Red Cross parcels. The German guards, they would take all the food out, put it in one pile, mix it all up, and then they'd give it to the prisoners.
Hmm.
You couldn't eat it. It was like slop.
Ruined it.
Ruined it.
You must have lost a lot of weight.
I weighed 102 pounds when I was liberated.
Wow. I bet you ate some things that you never would have stomached before.
Oh, I told some of the prisoners, don't eat the slop. Now, I'm not blaming you if you eat it, because we're not getting anything to eat from the Germans.
Right.
Maybe some kartoffels or something, bread.
Was that the bread made out of sawdust?
Yeah. And then Colonel Waters, an enlisted man, comes up and he says, Captain, Colonel Waters wants to talk to you. So I knew Colonel Waters was head of the camp. He calls me in, and I was going to salute him. He says, no saluting in this camp. He says, I heard that you're a pretty good man. And I didn't say a word to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he said to me, how would you like to work for me in the camp? I said, I would like to do that, Colonel. He says, I want you to call me by my first name. I'm John Waters. And I knew who he was.
Did you know who his father-in-law was?
Yeah. I says, you happen to be General Patton's son-in-law? He says, yes. He says, how did you know? I says, well, I know the Patton family from before the war and during the war. And I was not impressed with his command ability. He looked at me and he says, well, why weren't you impressed? He was a 3-star general. I said, yes. And they took 1 star away from him because of the way he treated the enlisted men who were wounded and in the hospital. So he says, oh, you're one of those guys. I said, yes. He says, well, he says, you and I are going to be good friends, I can see. He says, I don't like him either. I said, he's your father-in-law. He says, I think that you are an honest person. I want you to work for me. Oh, One other thing. My name is John, and you're Alan. That's what we're going to talk. No rank.
Right.
I said, yes, sir. He said, no, sir. He made rules as he went along. He made rules.
So what kind of work did he have you doing there in the camp?
He had me go around to the officers in the 422nd and the 423rd, the officers who were POWs, mm-hmm. and he wanted me to tell them he is doing everything possible to get them released and sent back to their families and the American troops.
What was the hardest thing about being a prisoner? What was the most challenging part of that for you?
The hardest thing in being a POW was the lack of freedom. When you're used to doing what you please most of the time, your freedom is so important to you, and your lack of communication with your family.
Did you ever hear from them in captivity?
The mail that they sent was either destroyed or the Germans just threw them away.
So you never knew whether or not your family knew you were alive.
That's right.
But did they?
Yeah.
They knew you were reported missing and reported captured?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They got it through the grapevine, I guess. I was working for this man.
For Waters, yeah.
Yeah. I had to report to him of everything I saw during the prisoner of war camp that I thought was wrong. Some of the prisoners were trying to escape without him knowing about it. That's not right.
Probably wasn't smart either.
Wasn't smart either. Of course, you get yourself killed.
Exactly.
That way.
Yeah. Did you ever, during those months of captivity, while you're starving, you're losing weight, did you ever think you were going to die there, that you wouldn't be free again?
I never thought about that.
Why not? What gave you hope?
Hope, because I was an American, and I felt that someday they would become better trained, and they would liberate either the camp or they would win the war.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any doubts in my mind that the Americans would win the war.
Well, and America and its allies certainly proved you right. But in order to make it home, you had to regain your freedom first, and that was not a simple process. When we come back, some of the things he had to endure before his liberation came, and how he thinks we ought to view our freedom today. For photos of Mr. Dunbar then and now, pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook, and we'll hear the rest of his story right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with a pretty incredible 96-year-old, Alan Dunbar, who served with the 106th Infantry Division during World War II. He was one of 6,000 men, two full regiments from that division, who were surrendered together after being surrounded during the early days of the Battle of the Bulge. He was taken first to Oflag 64, an all-officer camp in Poland, but he'd be moved to two different POW camps, Oflag 13B and Stalag 7A, before he'd taste freedom again. Let's pick it up while still at that first camp in snowy Zubin, Poland.
There were a lot of rumors going around.
About the Russians?
About the Russians.
And you didn't want to get captured by them, did you?
No.
Or liberated by
no.
them? Because that would be being captured by them.
Yeah. So we were very happy when they kept going to the west.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the prisoner of war camp called Habelberg. It was in Germany.
They moved you to get you away from the advancing Russians?
Right.
Okay.
And advancing Russians and the German army, too, that was in Europe. So Colonel Waters was the type of individual that you could trust
mm-hmm.
with anything you might have to say.
Right.
I learned that very early in being with him. He was very honest with me, and he said something to me that I started to laugh because I thought it was funny. He says, oh, by the way, since I'm a graduate of West Point, he says, I'll probably end up as a general. And I said to him, I said, you and I have an agreement. We only talk to each other by our first names. And if you become a general, you mean to tell me you're not going to expect me to say, call you General? He says, yeah, you and I are friends. You're Alan. I'm John.
So he got wounded in the transition between camps?
Yeah, here's what happened.
Yep.
We were at Hammelburg. We were ready to be sent to this camp in Moochburg.
Right.
Which was north of where we were. So Patton sent a task force to Hammelburg to liberate the camp and liberate his son-in-law.
Right.
The task force got beat up.
It was a failed attempt.
Failed attempt. And Waters decides to go out and greet the men who was sent by Patton to liberate the camp. But they didn't liberate the camp. They all got captured.
So they get captured trying to liberate them, and he goes out to meet the new prisoners that are coming in, that were the guys that were supposed to liberate it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And guess what? Somebody shot him in the back. A German guard shot
Waters in the
back.
Mm-hmm.
He was critically wounded. So when I saw him after he had been wounded, I said to him, I said, you have a wound. It's either going to kill you or is it going to really, you'll really be disabled. I said, John, I said, this is the worst wound you can have. You're shot in the back. That bullet is lodged up against your spine.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the hole in the bag. I mean, I don't know how he was talking to me. So he said, Alan, he said, I guess this is going to be a parting of the ways. I said, John, I said, I'm praying to God that you survive. So he said, I'll see you in heaven.
And I know you're both still looking forward to that meeting, but he would make it home safely. You've been in touch with his family over the years, and you've been very clear how much John Waters meant to you. This is the man, when they were marching you to Hammelburg and your feet were so swollen you couldn't even walk, he convinced the Germans to take you in the meat wagon that they used for all the wounded. The same guy who would come get you from that wagon and carry you to the barn so you could sleep at night. And it sounds like he just had the kind of monumental impact on your life that you seem eternally grateful for.
I didn't think that I would have lived. He, being the son-in-law of this man, carried weight with the Germans. He was like a god to the Germans.
Patton was.
Patton was.
Yeah.
That he couldn't be killed. That he was from the way back in history.
Well, that's what he believed. Patton believed he was Napoleon and Julius Caesar reincarnated.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Germans believed that.
We're almost out of time, but I need to hear the story of your liberation and what that felt like for you.
Oh, well, we finally get into Moochburg.
Right.
Patton sent another task force to liberate Moochburg, and he did.
So you saw the tanks come through the gate.
I saw the tanks come through the tank gate, and I saw the troops coming in, and I saw the Germans throwing their arms down, and I said, we're free. And then this guy comes into the camp.
General Patton comes right into the camp in Moochburg.
He comes into Moochburg. He's riding a Jeep that's painted gold. And he's in there, and he's got his feet like this. He's got jumpers on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those pants that they
ride. He was famous for them.
Oh,
yeah.
And two silver revolvers, silver helmet with three stars up there. And he's got this batter on, and he tells the men, calls them all. He says, I hope you could hear me. 1,500 Allied soldiers, American soldiers, you are going home. I am liberating you. You're going aboard 100 planes. We'll be here to pick you up. And some character goes out there, screw that. I want to get on a plane now. And everybody, all the POWs, they started to laugh. 47, the
C-47.
C-47s. Half the POWs, they were dressed like bums.
Well, sure.
I mean, we looked like bums. I mean, I hadn't shaved in who knows when. I had a beard and everything. I was afraid to go on the plane. Got to France.
Right.
They flew us to France. They examined us.
Yeah.
To see whether we were fit to go home.
Right.
Or fit to go aboard the ship. There was a ship waiting in the harbor.
What was the American port that you came into?
First, we landed in New York Harbor.
Did you sail past something that had some significance there?
Statue of Liberty.
So they took you right past Lady Liberty.
They put Liberty, and then we docked in New Brunswick.
Mm-hmm.
And they put us on buses and took us home.
What did that mean to you? You told me that the hardest thing about being a prisoner was just living in the absence of freedom. And then you sail past the symbol of freedom and liberty. What did that mean to you to see that again?
Well, it meant that a lot of people died for us to get home. And I thought about them. And I thought about my family. What are they going to feel about me being a POW?
And are they even going to recognize you?
Yeah, I only weighed 102 pounds.
So you got to go home and see your mother and
yes,
your father?
I got home to see my mother and father. And my mother was beside herself. And she said, I knew she was going to say it. She said, the only thing missing is your brother Joe. And he died a hero's death. And when I read the letter, Frank Knox sent to my mother and father on Joe's death, I started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
I said, here's a man who was Secretary of the Navy. Frank Knox sent a letter to my mother telling her of Joe's death and what he meant to the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, Joe had to die for a reason. And, you know, I couldn't find the reason. I didn't know why. Why they took Joe and didn't take me after what I've been through. And my brother, who was in the Far Eastern fighting a war, why he wasn't taken. It was very difficult for me to comprehend. I had a lot of questions to ask the military, but I never got around to it.
Do you have any answers now?
Some, but they're not satisfying to me.
Can't bring them back.
The only thing I can remember was coming into New York Harbor and seeing the Statue of Liberty. I cried.
Mm-hmm.
I really did. But the hardest thing was trying to regain my sense of humor and my thoughts about the men who were killed.
Over 400,000 of them.
And I had memories and nightmares before I finally got rid of it, of the men that I personally trained. And you know what I did?
Huh.
I wrote to the parents.
When you found out someone had died, you wrote to the parents and told them what you thought of them?
I told them that they were good soldiers, that they thought of them always, and that they were the best that United States Army had.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
No, and it's something that I want to do before I die. There are a lot of things I want to do before I die. I personally want to visit all the addresses I have, and it's going to be tough for me to find some of them.
To surviving family members?
Yes, to surviving family members. There's one man I'm looking for, Kinoy. I can't find him.
Yeah. How do you spell it?
K-I-N-O-Y.
Okay. I'll do some research. Do you remember his first name?
Ernest.
Ernest Kinoy. Okay.
Ernest Kinoy.
I'll look for it.
I want to tell you. I want to thank you for coming because it reminded me of my responsibility as a platoon leader, talking to you. I felt that I was a damn good officer to my men. And I hated to lose one of them.
And I want to thank you for serving our country, for telling us a story that no one else could. I guess the last thing I'd be interested in knowing from you, after everything that you went through, living without freedom, I'm sure you appreciate it more because of that, losing a brother in the war and knowing that 400,000 other Americans died.
Yeah.
what should we remember about that price and what it bought for our country?
I am proud of the men that I trained. I was proud of the men who didn't make it home. I was proud to be an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was proud that I was born in America. And I am only maybe one of a very few that had this experience. And I want the United States to know that there are many more men who should be honored
mm-hmm.
for what they did.
Amen.
And don't ever forget our relationship to those who didn't come home, and remember our freedom. It's hard bought.
That is the perfect way to wrap things up. And it means a little more when you hear from someone who lived without freedom as a prisoner of war and lost a brother who made the ultimate sacrifice during World War II. Alan Dunbar, nearly 97 years old, an amazing story we had the privilege of hearing today. And one final note, you heard Mr. Dunbar say he really wanted to track down Ernest Canoy, that talented radio operator he had helped over the wall to make sure he could keep him in his outfit. I did a little research, as I promised Mr. Dunbar I would. Turns out Mr. Canoy also became a prisoner of war. When the Germans learned that he was Jewish, he was moved from a prisoner of war camp to a slave labor camp. But he survived, and Canoy went on to a prolific career as an Emmy Award-winning screenplay writer. He wrote Broadway musicals, too, even worked some of his war experiences into some of the things that he wrote. And I have some more information on Mr. Canoy linked at hometownheroesradio.com. I've also passed all of this on to Mr. Dunbar, but here's the unfortunate part. Mr. Canoy died in November 2014, just 3 months before Mr. Dunbar and I sat down for this interview. I'm sorry we couldn't make that connection sooner, but Mr. Dunbar is reaching out to Canoy's family so he can share his memories and his warm sentiments about the hero that they just recently lost. A lot of twists and turns in this episode of Hometown Heroes. Thanks for sticking around for the ride. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time, and reminding you, as Alan Dunbar did so powerfully, that freedom is not free.